Grenthal off guard. For some of the lesser houses, there never has been and never will be a better opportunity to unseat this house, Matron Bayenry went on, speaking to all of them. If you think to unseat me, then do so, but know that it will do little to change the rebellion that is rising against us. She huffed and threw her arms up helplessly. Indeed, you would only be aiding our enemies. I am your tie to break in the earth, and know that our enemies have also courted Jarlaxle, and I am Bayenry, not Triel, and not Quenthel. Without me you would all fall to chaos, fighting for control, each with your own factions within the House Guard. Where will you be when Kioral O'Blodra enters the compound? It was a sobering thought. Matron Bayenry had passed word to each of them that the O'Blodrins had not lost their powers, and all the Bayenrys knew the hatred the Third House held for them. "Now is not the time for personal ambitions," Matron Bayenry reiterated. "Now is the time for us to hold together and hold our position." The nods around her were sincere, Bayenry knew, though Quenthel was not nodding. "You should hope that Lolth does not come back to me before she returns to you," the ambitious sister said boldly, aiming the remark squarely at Triel. Triel seemed unimpressed. "You should hope that Lolth comes back at all," she replied casually. "Else I will tear off your head and have Grumph place it atop Narbondale, that your eyes may glow when the day is full." Quenthel went to reply, but Grumph beat her to it.
"A pleasure, my dear sister," he said to Triel.
There was no love lost between the two, but while Grumph was ambivalent towards Triel, he perfectly hated Quenthel and her dangerous ambitions. If House Bayenry fell, so too would Grumph. The implied alliance between the two elder Bayenry children worked wonders in calming the upstart younger sister, and Quenthel said not another word the rest of the meeting.
"May we speak now of Kioral and the danger to us all?" Matron Bayenry asked.
When no dissenting voices came forth, and if there had been, Bayenry likely would have run out of patience and had the speaker put to a slow death, the matron mother took up the issue of house defense. She explained that Jarlaxle and his band could still be trusted, but warned that the mercenary would be one to change sides if the battle was going badly for House Bayenry. Triel assured them all that the Academy remained loyal, and Bourguignon's report of the readiness of the House Guard was beaming. Despite the promising news and the well-earned reputation of the Bayenry garrison, the conversation ultimately came down to the only apparent way to fully fend off Kioral and her psionic family. Bourguignon, who had taken part in the fight with the dwarf Gandalag, voiced it first.
"What of Methil?" he asked. "And the 100 Illithids he represents. If they stand with us, the threat from House O'Blodra seems minor."
The others nodded their agreement with the assessment, but Matron Bayenry knew that such friends as Mind Flayers could not be counted on.
"Methil remains at our side, because he and his people know we are the keystone of security for his people. The Illithids do not number 1/100th the Drow in Menzel Berenzon. That is the extent of their loyalty. If Methil comes to believe that House O'Blodra is the stronger, he will not stand beside us."
Bayenry gave an ironic, seemingly helpless chuckle.
"The other Illithids might even side with Kioral," she reasoned. "The wretch is akin to them with her powers of the mind. Perhaps they understand one another."
"Should we speak so bluntly?"
so some two asked. She looked about the dais, concerned, and the others understood that she feared Methil might even be among them, invisibly, hearing every word, reading their every thought.
"It does not matter," Matron Bayenry replied casually. "Methil already knows my fears. One cannot hide from an Illithid."
"Then what are we to do?"
Triel asked.
"We are to muster our strength," Bayenry replied determinedly. We ought to show no fear and no weakness, and we are not to do anything that might push Lolf further from us."
She aimed that last remark at the rivals, Quenthel and Triel, particularly at Triel, who seemed more than ready to use this Lolf-absent time to be rid of her troublesome sister.
"We must show the Illithids we remain the power in Menzel Berenzon," Beanri went on. "If they know this, then they will side with us, not wanting House Beanri to be weakened by Kioral's advances."
"I go to Sorcerer," said Gromph the Archmage.
"And I to Eric Tynalith,"
added a determined Triel. "I make no illusions about friendship among my rivals," Gromph added. "But a few promises of repayment when issues sort themselves out will go far in finding allies."
"The students have been allowed no contact outside the school," Triel put in. "They know of the problems in general, of course, but they know nothing of the threat to House Beanri. In their ignorance, they remain loyal."
Matron Beanri nodded to both of them.
"And you will meet with the lower houses that we have established," she said to Quenthel,
a most important assignment. A large portion of House Beanri's power lay in the dozen minor houses that former Beanri nobles had come to head. So obviously a favorite of Lolf's, Quenthel was the perfect choice for such an assignment. Her expression revealed that she had been won over, more by Triel and Gromp's threats, no doubts, than by the tidbit that had just been thrown her way. The most important ingredient in squashing the rivalries, Beanri knew, was to allow both Triel and Quenthel to save face and feel important. Thus, this meeting had been a success, and all the power of House Beanri would be coordinated into a single defensive force. Beanri's smile remained a meager one, though. She knew what Methil could do, and suspected that Kioral was not so much weaker. All of House Beanri would be ready, but without the Lolf-given clerical magic and Gromp's wizardly prowess, would that be enough? Just off Brunner's audience hall, on the top level of Mithril Hall, was a small room that the Dwarf King had set aside for the artisans working on repairing the panther figurine. Inside was a small forge and delicate tools, along with dozens of beakers and flasks containing various ingredients and salves. Drizzt was eager indeed when he was summoned to that room. He'd gone there a dozen times a day, of course, but without invitation, and every time to find dwarves huddled over the still-broken artifact and shaking their bearded heads. A 10-day had passed since the incident, and Guinevere was so exhausted that she could no longer stand, could barely lift her head from her paws as she lay in front of the hearth in Drizzt's room. The waiting was the worst part. Now, though, Drizzt had been called into the room. He knew that an emissary had arrived that morning from Silvery Moon. He could only hope that Elustriel had some positive solutions to offer. Brunner was watching his approach through the open door of the audience chamber. The red-bearded dwarf nodded and poked his head to the side, and Drizzt cut the sharp corner, pushing open the door without bothering to knock. It was among the most curious of sights that Drizzt O'Urden had ever witnessed. The broken, still broken figurine was on a small round table. Regis stood beside it, working furiously with a mortar and pestle, mushing some blackish substance. Across the table from Drizzt stood a short, stout dwarf, Buster Bracer, the noted armorer, the one, in fact, who had forged Drizzt's own supple chainmail back in Icewind Dale. Drizzt didn't dare greet the dwarf now, fearing to upset his obvious concentration. Buster stood with his feet wide apart. Every so often he took an exaggerated breath, then held perfectly steady, for in his hands, wrapped in wetted cloth of the finest material, he held eyeballs. Drizzt had no idea what was going on until a voice, a familiar, bubbly voice, startled him from his shock.
"Greetings, O One of the Midnight Skin,"
the disembodied wizard said happily.
"Harkle Harple?" Drizzt asked.
"Could it be anyone else?"
Regis remarked dryly. Drizzt conceded the point. "What is this about?" he asked.
pointedly looking toward the halfling, for he knew that any answer from Harkle would likely shed more dimness on the blurry situation. Regis lifted the mixing bowl a bit.
"A poultice from Silvery Moon," he explained hopefully. "Harkle has overseen its mixing."
"Overseen," the absent mage joked, "which means they held my eyes over the bowl."
Drizzt didn't manage a smile, not with the head of the all-important figurine still lying at the sculpted body's feet. Regis snickered, more in disdain than humor.
"It should be ready," he explained, "but I wanted you to apply it."
"Drow fingers are so dexterous,"
Harkle piped in. "Where are you?" Driz demanded, impatient and unnerved by the outrageous arrangement. Harkle blinked, those eyelids appearing from thin air.
"In Nesme," the mage replied. "We will be passing north of the Trollmoor soon."
"And to Mithril Hall, where you will be reunited with your eyes," Drizzt said.
"I am looking forward to it," Harkle roared, but again he laughed alone.
"He keeps that up, and I'm throwing the damned eyes into me forge,"
Buster Bracer growled. Regis placed the bowl on the table and received a tiny metal tool.
"You'll not need much of the poultice,"
the halfling said as he handed the delicate instrument to Drizzt.
"And Harkle has warned us to try to keep the mixture on the outside of the joined pieces."
"It is only a glue," the mage's voice added. "The magic of the figurine will be the force that truly makes the item whole. The poultice will have to be scraped away in a few days' time. If it works as planned, the figurine will be—"
He paused, searching for the word.
"Will be healed,"
he finished. "If it works," Drizzt echoed. He took a moment to feel the delicate instrument in his hands, making sure that the burns he had received when the figurine's magic had gone awry were healed, making sure that he could feel the item perfectly.
"It will work,"
Regis assured. Drizzt took a deep, steadying breath and picked up the panther head. He stared into the sculpted eyes, so much like Guinevere's own knowing orbs. With all the care of a parent tending its child, Drizzt placed the head against the body and began the painstaking task of spreading the glue-like poultice around its perimeter. More than 2 hours passed before Drizzt and Regis exited the room, moving into the audience hall where Brunner was still meeting with Lady Illustrial's emissary and several other dwarves. Brunner did not appear happy, but Drizzt noted he seemed more at ease than he had since the onset of this strange time.
"It ain't a trick of the drow,"
the dwarf king said as soon as Drizzt and Regis approached.
"Or the damned drow are more powerful than anyone ever thought. It's all the world, so says Illustrial."
"Lady Illustrial,"
corrected the emissary, a very tidy-looking dwarf dressed in flowing white robes and with a short and neatly trimmed beard.
"My greetings, Fredegar," Drizzt said, recognizing Fredegar Rockcrusher, better known as Fret, Lady Illustrial's favored bard and advisor.
"So at last you have found the opportunity to see the wonders of Mithril Hall."
"Would that the times were better,"
Fret answered glumly.
"Pray tell me, how fares Catti Bree?"
"She is well," Drizzt answered. He smiled as he thought of the young woman, who had returned to Settlestone to convey some information from Brunner.
"It ain't a trick of a drow,"
Brunner said again, more emphatically, making it clear that he didn't consider this the proper time and place for such light and meaningless conversation. Drizzt nodded his agreement. He had been assuring Brunner that his people were not involved all along. "Whatever has happened, it has rendered Regis's ruby useless," the drow said. He reached over and lifted the pendant from the halfling's chest. "Now it is but a plain, though undeniably beautiful, stone, and the unknown force has affected Guinevere and reached all the way to the Harples. No magic of the drow is this powerful, else they would have long ago conquered the surface world."
"Something new?"
Brunner asked.
"The effects have been felt for several 10 days now," Fret interjected.
though only in the last couple of 10 days has magic become so totally unpredictable and dangerous.
Brunner, never one to care much for magic, snorted loudly.
It's a good thing, then, he decided. The damned drow are more needin' magic than are me own folk, or the men of Settlestone. Let all the magic drain away, I'm saying, and let the drow come on and play.
Thibbledorf Puent nearly jumped out of his boots at that thought. He leaped over to stand before Brunner and Fret, and slapped one of his dirty, smelly hands across the tidy dwarf's back. Few things could calm an excited battle-rager, but Fret's horrified, then outraged look did just that, surprising Puent completely.
What?
The battle-rager demanded.
If you ever touch me again, I will crush your skull.
Fret, who wasn't half the size of powerful Puent, promised in an even tone, and for some inexplicable reason, Puent believed him and backed off a step. Drizzt, who knew Tidy Fret quite well from his many visits to Silvery Moon, understood that Fret couldn't stand 10 seconds in a fight against Puent, unless the confrontation centered around dirt. In that instance, with Puent messing up Fret's meticulous grooming, Drizzt would put all of his coin on Fret, as sure a bet as the drow would ever know. It wasn't an issue, though, for Puent, boisterous as he was, would never do anything against Brunner, and Brunner obviously wanted no trouble with an emissary, particularly a dwarven emissary from friendly Silvery Moon. Indeed, all in the room had a good laugh at the confrontation, and all seemed more relaxed at the realization that these strange events were not connected to the mysterious dark elves. All except for Drizzt O'Erden. Drizzt would not relax until the figurine was repaired, its magic restored, and poor Guinevere could return to her home on the astral plane.
Chapter 10 The Third House. It wasn't that Jarlaxle, who always thought ahead of others, hadn't been expecting the visit. It was simply the ease with which Kiorel Odrin entered his camp, slipped past his guards, and walked right through the wall of his private chambers that so unnerved him. He saw her ghostly outline enter and fought hard to compose himself as she became more substantial and more threatening.
"I had expected you would come many days ago," Jarlaxle said calmly.
"Is this the proper greeting for a matron mother?"
Kiorel asked. Jarlaxle almost laughed until he considered the female's stance. Too at ease, he decided, too ready to punish, even to kill. Kiorel did not understand the value of Bregendyerth, apparently, and that left Jarlaxle, the master of bluff and the player of intrigue, at somewhat of a disadvantage. He came up from his comfortable chair, stepped out from behind his desk, and gave a low bow, pulling his wide-brimmed and outrageously plumed hat from his head and sweeping it across the floor.
"My greetings, Kiorel Odrin, matron mother of House Oblodra, third house of Menzo Berenzon. Not often has my humble home been so graced."
"Enough!"
Kiorel spat, and Jarlaxle came up and replaced the hat. Never taking his gaze from the female, never blinking, the mercenary went back to his chair and flopped down comfortably, putting both his boots atop his desk with a resounding slam. It was then Jarlaxle felt the intrusion into his mind, a deeply unsettling probe into his thoughts. He quickly dismissed his many curses at the failure of conventional magic. Usually his enchanted eye patch would have protected him from such a mental intrusion, and used his wits instead. He focused his gaze on Kiorel, pictured her with her clothes off, and filled his mind with thoughts so base that the matron mother, in the midst of serious business, lost all patience.
"I could have the skin flailed from your bones for such thoughts,"
Kiorel informed him.
"Such thoughts?" Jarlaxle said, as though he had been wounded. "Surely you are not intruding on my mind, Matron Kiorel. Though I am but a male, such practices are surely frowned on. Loth would not be pleased."
"Damn Loth!"
Kiorel growled, and Jarlaxle was stunned that she had put it so clearly, so bluntly.
Of course, everyone knew that House Oblodr was not the most religious of drow houses, but the Oblodrans had always kept at least the pretense of piety. Gural tapped her temple, her features stern.
If Loth was worthy of my praise, then she would have recognized the truth of power, the matron mother explained. It is the mind that separates us from our lessers, the mind that should determine order.
Jarlaxle offered no response. He had no desire to get into this argument with so dangerous and unpredictable a foe. Kiorl did not press the point, but simply waved her hand as if throwing it all away. She was frustrated, Jarlaxle could see, and in this one frustration equated with danger.
"It is beyond the Spider Queen now," Kiorl said. "I am beyond Loth. And it begins this day."
Jarlaxle allowed a look of surprise to cross his features.
"You expected it,"
Kiorl said accusingly. That was true enough. Jarlaxle had wondered why the Oblodrans had waited this long with all the other houses so vulnerable, but he would not concede the point.
"Where in this does Braigendieth stand?"
Kiorl demanded. Jarlaxle got the feeling that any answer he gave would be moot, since Kiorl was probably going to tell him exactly where Braigendieth stood. "With the victors," he said cryptically and casually. Kiorl smiled in salute to his cleverness.
"I will be the victor,"
she assured him.
"It will be over quickly, this very day, and with few drow dead."
Jarlaxle doubted that. House Oblodra had never shown any regard for life, be it drow or otherwise. The drow numbers within the third house were small, mainly because the wild clan members killed as often as they bred. They were renowned for a game that they played, a challenge of the highest stakes called Kaelas. Ironically, the drow word for trust. A globe of darkness and magical silence would be hung in the air above the deepest point in the chasm called the Claw Rift. The competing dark elves would then levitate into the globe, and there, unable to see or hear, it would become a challenge of simple and pure courage. The first one to come out of the globe and back to secure footing was the loser, so the trick was to remain in the globe until the very last second of the levitation enchantment. More often than not, both stubborn competitors would wait too long and would plunge to their demise. Now Kiorl, merciless and ultimately wicked, was trying to assure Jarlaxle that the drow losses would be kept at a minimum. By whose standard, the mercenary wondered. And if the answer was Kiorl's, then likely half the city would be dead before the end of the day. There was little Jarlaxle could do about that, he realized. He and Braigendieth were as dependent on magic as any other dark elf camps, and without it he couldn't even keep Kiorl out of his private chamber, even his private thoughts.
"This day," Kiorl said again grimly, "and when it is done, I will call for you and you will come."
Jarlaxle didn't nod, didn't answer at all. He didn't have to. He could feel the mental intrusion again, and knew that Kiorl understood him. He hated her, and hated what she was about to do. But Jarlaxle was ever pragmatic, and if things went as Kiorl predicted, then he would indeed go to her call. She smiled again and faded away. Then, like a ghost, she simply walked through Jarlaxle's stone wall. Jarlaxle rested back in his chair, his fingers tapping nervously together. He had never felt so vulnerable, or so caught in the middle of an uncontrollable situation. He could get word to Matron Bayenry, of course, but to what gain? Even House Bayenry, so vast and proud, could not stand against Kiorl when her magic worked and theirs did not. Likely, Matron Bayenry would be dead soon, and all her family with her, and where would the mercenary hide? He would not hide, of course. He would go to Kiorl's call. Jarlaxle understood why Kiorl had paid him the visit, and why it was important to her, who seemed to have everything in her favor, to enlist him in her court.
He and his band were the only drow in Menzo Berenzon with any true ties outside the city, a crucial factor for anyone aspiring to the position of First Matron Mother. Not that anyone other than Matron Beenri had aspired to that coveted position in close to 1,000 years. Jarlaxle's fingers continued tapping. Perhaps it was time for a change, he thought. He quickly dismissed that hopeful notion, for even if he was right, this change did not seem for the better. Apparently, though, Kioro believed that the situation with conventional magic was a temporary thing, else she would not have been so interested in enlisting Bregan de Earth. Jarlaxle had to believe, had to pray that she was right, especially if her coup succeeded, and the mercenary had no reason to believe it would not. He would not survive long, he realized, if First Matron Mother Kioral, a drow he hated above all others, could enter his thoughts at will. She was too beautiful to be drow, seemed the perfection of drow features to any male or female who looked at her. It was this beauty alone that held in check the deadly lances and crossbows of the House Beenri guard, and made Bourguignon Beenri, after one glance at her, bid her enter the compound. The magical fence wasn't working, and there were no conventional gates in the perimeter of the Beenri household. Normally, the spider web of the fence would spiral out, opening a wide hole on command, but now Bourguignon had to ask the drow to climb over. She said not a word, but simply approached the fence. Spiral wide it did. One last gasp of magic before this creature, the avatar of the goddess who had created it. Bourguignon led the way, though he knew beyond doubt that this one needed no guidance. He understood that she was heading for the chapel. Of course she would be heading for the chapel, so he instructed some of his soldiers to find the matron mother. Sosumtu met them at the door of the chapel, the place that was in her care. She protested for an instant, but just for an instant. Bourguignon had never seen his devoted sister so flustered, had never seen her jaw go slack for lack of strength. She fell away from them, to her knees. The beautiful drow walked past her without a word. She turned sharply. Sosumtu gasped and put her glare over Bourguignon as he continued to follow.
"You are just a male," Sosumtu whispered in explanation. "Be gone from this holy place."
Bourguignon was too stricken to reply, to even sort out how he felt at that moment. He never turned his back, just gave a series of ridiculous bows, and verily fell through the chapel's door, back out into the courtyard. Both Bladen Kirst and Quenthel were out there, but the rest of the group that had gathered in response to the whispered rumors had wisely been dispersed by the sisters.
"Go back to your post,"
Bladen Kirst snarled at Bourguignon.
"Nothing has happened."
It wasn't so much a statement as a command.
"Nothing has happened,"
Bourguignon echoed, and that became the order of the day, and a wise one, Bourguignon immediately realized. This was Lolth herself, or some close minion. He knew this in his heart. He knew it, and the soldiers would whisper it, but their enemies must not learn of this. Bourguignon scrambled across the courtyard, past the word, the command that nothing had happened. He took up a post that allowed him an overview of the chapel, and was surprised to see that his ambitious sisters dared not enter, but rather paced around the main entrance nervously. Sosumtu came out as well and joined their parade. No words were openly exchanged. Bourguignon didn't even notice any flashes of the silent hand code as Matron Beenri hustled across the courtyard. She passed by her daughters and scurried into the chapel, and the pacing outside began anew. For Matron Beenri, it was the answer to her prayers and the realization of her nightmares all at once. She knew immediately who and what it was that sat before her on the central dais. She knew, and she believed.
"If I am the offending person, then I offer myself," she began humbly, falling to her knees as she spoke. "Well,"
The avatar snapped at her, the drow word for fool, and Bienri hid her face in her hands with shame.
Ustan Sarg Wail,
the beautiful drow went on, calling Matron Bienri an arrogant fool. Bienri trembled at the verbal attack, thought for a moment that she had sunk lower than her worst fears, that her goddess had come personally for no better reason than to shame her to death. Images of her tortured body being dragged through the winding avenues of Menzo Berenzon flashed in her mind, thoughts of herself as the epitome of a fallen drow leader. Yet thoughts such as that were exactly what this creature, who was more than a drow, had just berated her about, Matron Bienri suddenly realized. She dared look up.
"Do not place so much importance on yourself,"
the avatar said calmly. Matron Bienri allowed herself to breathe a sigh of relief. Then this wasn't about her, she understood. All of this, the failure of magic and prayer, was beyond her, beyond all the mortal realms.
"Kioril has erred," the avatar went on,
reminding Bienri that while these catastrophic events might be above her, their ramifications most certainly were not.
"She has dared to believe that she can win without your favor,"
Matron Bienri reasoned. And her surprise was total when the avatar scoffed at the notion.
"She could destroy you with a thought."
Matron Bienri shuddered and lowered her head once more.
"But she has erred on the side of caution," the avatar went on. "She delayed her attack, and now, when she decided that the advantage was indeed hers to hold, she has allowed a personal feud to delay her most important strike even longer."
"Then the powers have returned,"
Bienri gasped.
"You are returned."
"Well,"
the frustrated avatar screamed.
"Did you think I would not return?"
Matron Bienri fell flat to the floor and groveled with all her heart.
"The time of troubles will end,"
the avatar said a moment later, calm once more.
"And you will know what you must do when all is as it should be."
Bienri looked up just long enough to see the avatar's narrow-eyed glare full upon her.
"Do you think I am so resourceless?"
the beautiful drow asked. A horrified expression, purely sincere, crossed Bienri's face, and she began to numbly shake her head back and forth, denying she had ever lost faith. Again she lay flat out, groveling, and stopped her prayers only when something hard hit the floor beside her head. She dared to look up, to find a lump of yellow stone, sulfur, lying beside her.
"You must fend off Kioril for a short while," the avatar explained. "Go join the matron mothers and your eldest daughter and son in the meeting room. Stoke the flames, and allow those I have enlisted to come through to your side. Together, we will teach Kioril the truth of power."
A bright smile erupted on Bienri's face with the realization that she was not out of Loth's favor, that her goddess had called on her to play a crucial role in this crucial hour. The fact that Loth had all but admitted she was still rather impotent did not matter. The Spider Queen would return, and Bienri would shine again in her devious eyes. By the time Matron Bienri mustered the courage to come off the floor, the beautiful drow had already exited the chapel. She crossed the compound without interference, walked through the fence as she had done at her arrival, and disappeared into the shadows of the city. As soon as she heard the awful rumor that House O'Blodra's strange psionic powers had not been too adversely affected by whatever was happening to other magic, Jenny Tiroth Tlabar, the matron mother of Faean Tlabar, Menzo Berenzon's fourth house, knew she was in dire trouble. Kioril Odron hated the tall, slender Jenny Tiroth above all others,
for Jenny Tiroth had made no secret of the fact that she believed Feanthlabar and not Oplodra should rank as Menzo Baranzon's third house. With almost 800 drow soldiers, Feanthlabar's number nearly doubled that of House Oplodra, and only the little-understood powers of Kioral and her minions had kept Feanthlabar back. How much greater those powers loomed now, with all conventional magic rendered unpredictable at best. Throughout it all, Jenny Tiroth remained in the house chapel, a relatively small room near the summit of her compound's central stalagmite mound. A single candle burned upon the altar, shedding minimal light by surface standards, but serving as a beacon to the dark elves whose eyes were more accustomed to blackness. A second source of illumination came from the room's west-facing window, for even from halfway across the city, the wild glow of Narbondale could be clearly seen. Jenny Tiroth showed little concern for the pillar clock, other than the significance it now held as an indicator of their troubles. She was among the most fanatical of Loth's priestesses, a drow female who had survived more than 6 centuries in unquestioning servitude to the Spider Queen. But she was in trouble now, and Loth, for some reason she could not understand, would not come to her call. She reminded herself constantly to keep fast her faith as she knelt and huddled over a platinum platter, the famed Feanthlabar communing plate. The heart of the latest sacrifice, a not-so-insignificant drow male, sat atop it, an offering to the goddess who would not answer Jenny Tiroth's desperate prayers. Jenny Tiroth straightened suddenly, as the heart rose from the bloody platter, came up several inches, and hovered in midair.
"The sacrifice is not sufficient," came a voice behind her,
a voice she had dreaded hearing since the advent of the Time of Troubles. She did not turn to face Kioral Odron.
"There is war in the compound,"
Jenny Tiroth stated more than asked. Kioral scoffed at the notion. A wave of her hand sent the sacrificial organ flying across the room. Jenny Tiroth spun around, eyes wide with outrage. She started to scream out the drow word for sacrilege, but stopped, the sound caught in her throat, as another heart floated in the air from Kioral toward her.
"The sacrifice was not sufficient,"
Kioral said calmly.
"Use this heart, the heart of Finithay."
Jenny Tiroth slumped back at the mention of the obviously dead priestess, her second in the house. Jenny Tiroth had taken in Finithay as her own daughter when Finithay's family, a lower-ranking and insignificant house, had been destroyed by a rival house. Insignificant indeed had been Finithay's house. Jenny Tiroth could not even remember its proper name. But Finithay had not been so. She was a powerful priestess, and ultimately loyal, even loving, to her adopted mother. Jenny Tiroth leaned back further, horrified, as her daughter's heart floated past and settled with a sickening wet sound on the platinum platter.
"Pray to Loth," Kioral ordered.
Jenny Tiroth did just that. Perhaps Kioral had erred, she thought. Perhaps in death, Finithay would prove most helpful, would prove a suitable sacrifice to bring the Spider Queen to the aid of House Feanthlabar. After a long and uneventful moment, Jenny Tiroth became aware of Kioral's laughter.
"Perhaps we are in need of a greater sacrifice,"
the wicked matron mother of House Oplodra said slyly. It wasn't difficult for Jenny Tiroth, the only figure in House Feanthlabar greater than Finithay, to figure out who Kioral was talking about. Secretly, barely moving her fingers, Jenny Tiroth brought her deadly poison dagger out of its sheath, under the concealing folds of her spider-emblazoned robes. Scragtooth, the dagger was called, and it had gotten a younger Jenny Tiroth out of many situations much like this. Of course, on those occasions, magic had been predictable, reliable, and those opponents had not been as formidable as Kiorl. Even as Jenny Tiroff locked gazes with the Oblodron, kept Kiorl distracted while she subtly shifted her hand. Kiorl read her thoughts and expected the attack. Jenny Tiroff shouted a command word, and the dagger's magic functioned, sending the missile shooting out from under her robes directly at the heart of her adversary. "The magic functioned!" Jenny Tiroff silently cheered. But her elation faded quickly, when the blade passed right through the specter of Kiorl Odron to embed itself uselessly in the fabric of a tapestry adorning the room's opposite wall.
"I do so hope the poison does not ruin the pattern,"
Kiorl, standing far to the left of her image, remarked. Jenny Tiroff shifted about and turned a steely-eyed gaze at the taunting creature.
"You cannot outfight me. You cannot outthink me," Kiorl said evenly. "You cannot even hide your thoughts from me. The war is ended before it ever began."
Jenny Tiroff wanted to scream out a denial, but found herself as silent as Finny Fay, whose heart lay on the platter before her.
"How much killing need there be?" Kiorl asked, catching Jenny Tiroff off her guard.
The matron of Feyn Tlabar turned a suspicious but ultimately curious expression toward her adversary.
"My house is small," Kiorl remarked.
And that was true enough, unless one counted the thousands of kobold slaves said to be running around the tunnels along the edges of the Claw Rift just below House Oblodra.
"And I am in need of allies, if I wish to depose that wretch Beenri and her bloated family."
Jenny Tiroff wasn't even conscious of the movement as her tongue came out and licked her thin lips. There was a flicker of hope.
"You cannot beat me," Kiorl said with all confidence. "Perhaps I will accept a surrender."
That word didn't sit well with the proud leader of the Third House.
"An alliance, then, if that is what you must call it," Kiorl clarified, recognizing the look. "It is no secret that I am not on the best of terms with the Spider Queen."
Jenny Tiroff rocked back on her legs, considering the implications. If she helped Kiorl, who was not in Loth's favor, overcome Beenri, then what would be the implications to her house if and when everything was sorted out?
"All of this is Beenri's fault,"
Kiorl remarked, reading Jenny Tiroff's every thought.
"Beenri brought about the Spider Queen's abandonment," Kiorl scoffed. "She could not even hold a single prisoner, could not even conduct a proper high ritual."
The words rang true, painfully true to Jenny Tiroff, who vastly preferred Matron Beenri to Kiorl Odron. She wanted to deny them, and yet, that surely meant her death, and the death of her house, since Kiorl held so obvious an advantage.
"Perhaps I will accept a surrender,"
Kiorl chuckled wickedly and caught herself in mid-sentence.
"Perhaps an alliance would benefit us both," she said instead.
Jenny Tiroff licked her lips again, not knowing where to turn. A glance at Finny Fay's heart did much to convince her, though.
"Perhaps it would," she said.
Kiorl nodded and smiled again, that devious and infamous grin that was known throughout Menzo Berenzon as an indication that Kiorl was lying. Jenny Tiroth returned the grin, until she remembered who it was she was dealing with, until she forced herself, through the temptation of the teasing bait that Kiorl had offered, to remember the reputation of this most wicked drow.
"Perhaps not," Kiorl said calmly,
and Jenny Tiroff was knocked backward suddenly by an unseen force, a physical though invisible manifestation of Kiorl's powerful will. The matron of Feyn Tlabar jerked and twisted, heard the crack of one of her ribs,
She tried to call out against Kiorel, to cry out to Loth in one final desperate prayer, but found her words garbled as an invisible hand grasped tightly on her throat, cutting off her air. Jenny Tiroff jerked again, violently, and again, and more cracking sounds came from her chest, from intense pressure within her torso. She rocked backward and would have fallen to the floor, except that Kiorel's will held her slender form fast.
"I am sorry Finny Fay was not enough to bring in your impotent spider queen," Kiorel taunted, brazenly blasphemous.
Jenny Tiroff's eyes bulged and seemed as if they would pop from their sockets. Her back arched weirdly, agonizingly, and gurgling sounds continued to stream from her throat. She tore at the flesh of her own neck, trying to grasp the unseen hand, but only drew lines of her own bright blood. Then there came a final crackle, a loud snapping, and Jenny Tiroff resisted no more. The pressure was gone from her throat, for what good that did her. Kiorel's unseen hand grabbed her hair and yanked her head forward, so that she looked down at the unusual bulge in her chest, beside her left breast. Jenny Tiroff's eyes widened in horror as her robes parted and her skin erupted. A great gout of blood and gore poured from the wound, and Jenny Tiroff fell limply, lying sidelong to the platinum plate. She watched the last beat of her own heart on that sacrificial platter.
"Perhaps Loth will hear this call," Kiorel remarked.
But Jenny Tiroff could no longer understand the words. Kiorel went to the body and retrieved the potion bottle that Jenny Tiroff carried, that all House Fae and Tlabar females carried. The mixture, a concoction that forced passionate servitude of drow males, was a potent one, or would be, if conventional magic returned. This bottle was likely the most potent, and Kiorel marked it well for a certain mercenary leader. Kiorel went to the wall and claimed Scragtooth as her own. "To the victor." With a final look to the dead matron mother, Kiorel called on her psionic powers and became less than substantial, became a ghost that could walk through the walls and past the guards of the well-defended compound. Her smile was supreme, as was her confidence. But as Loth's avatar had told Beanri, Odron had indeed erred. She had followed a personal vengeance, had struck out first against a lesser foe. Even as Kiorel drifted past the structures of House Fae and Tlabar, gloating over the death of her most hated enemy, Matrons Beanri and Mes Baris Armgo, along with Triel and Gromph Beanri, and the matron mothers of Menzo Baranzon's 5th through 8th houses, were gathered in a private chamber at the back of the Kellar's Orl, the raised plateau within the huge cavern that held some of the more important drow houses, including House Beanri. The 8 of them huddled, each to a leg, around the spider-shaped brazier set upon the small room's single table. Each had brought their most valuable of flammable items, and Matron Beanri carried the lump of sulfur that the Avatar had given her. None of them mentioned, but all of them knew that this might be their only chance. Chapter 11 Trump. Normally it pleased Jarlaxle to be in the middle of such a conflict, to be the object of wooing tactics by both sides in a dispute. This time, though, Jarlaxle was uneasy with the position. He didn't like dealing with Kiorel Odron on any account, as friends and especially not as enemies, and he was uneasy with House Beanri being so desperately involved in any struggle. Jarlaxle simply had too much invested with Matron Beanri. The wary mercenary leader usually didn't count on anything, but he had fully expected House Beanri to rule in Menzo Baranzon until at least the end of his life, as it had ruled since the beginning of his life and for millennia before that. It wasn't that Jarlaxle held any special feelings toward the city's first house. It was just that Beanri offered him an anchor point, a measure of permanence in the continually shifting power struggles of Menzo Baranzon.
It would last forever, so he had thought. But after talking with Kiorl, how he hated that one, Jarlaxle wasn't so sure. Kiorl wanted to enlist him, most likely wanted Bregendierth to serve as her connection with the world beyond Menzo Berenzon. They could do that, and do it well. But Jarlaxle doubted that he, who always had a private agenda, could remain in Kiorl's favor for long. At some point, sooner or later, she would read the truth in his mind, and she would dispatch and replace him. That was the way of the drow. The fiend was gargantuan, a giant, bipedal, dog-like creature with four muscled arms, two of which ended in powerful pincers. How it entered Jarlaxle's private cave, along the sheer facing of the claw rift, some 100 yards below and behind the compound of House Oblodra, none of the drow guards knew.
Tanari!
The warning word, the name of the greatest creatures of the abyss, known in all the languages of the realms, was passed in whispers and silent hand signals all through the complex, and the reaction to it was uniformly one of horror. Pity the two drow guards who first encountered the towering 15-foot monster. Loyal to Bregendierth, courageous in the belief that others would back their actions, they commanded the great beast to halt, and when it did not, the drow guards attacked. Had their weapons held their previous enchantment, they might have hurt the beast somewhat. But magic had not returned to the material plane in any predictable or reliable manner. Thus the Tanari, too, was deprived of its considerable spell repertoire, but the beast, 4,000 pounds of muscle and physical hazards, hardly needed magical assistance. The two drow were summarily dismembered, and the Tanari walked on, seeking Jarlaxle, as Ertu had bade it. It found the mercenary leader, along with a score of his finest soldiers around the first bend. Several drow leaped forward to the defense, but Jarlaxle, better understanding the power of this beast, held them at bay, was not so willing to throw away drow lives. Glabrezu, he said with all respect, recognizing the beast. Glabrezu's canine maw curled up in a snarl, and its eyes narrowed as it scrutinized Jarlaxle, privately confirming that it had found the correct dark elf.
"Beenri cocti emre noctero,"
the Tanari said in a growl. And without waiting for a response, the gigantic beast lumbered about and waddled away, crouching low so that its head did not scrape the corridor's high ceiling. Again, several brave, stupid drow moved as if to pursue, and again Jarlaxle, smiling now more widely than he had in many 10 days, held them back. The Tanari had spoken in the language of the lower planes, a language that Jarlaxle understood perfectly, and it had spoken the words Jarlaxle had longed to hear. The question was clear on the expressions of all the unnerved drow standing beside him. They did not understand the language and wanted desperately to know what the Tanari had said. "Beenri cock diemre noctero," Jarlaxle explained to them. "House Beenri will prevail." His wry smile, filled with hope, and the eager way he clenched his fists, told his soldiers that such a prediction was a good thing. Xerith Cusor-Lauren, matron mother of the fifth house, understood the significance of the makeup of the gathering. Trielen Gromf Beenri attended primarily to fill the 2 vacant spots at the spider-shaped brazier. One of those places rightfully belonged to Kiorl, and since they were gathered to fend off Kiorl, as the avatar of the Spider Queen had bade them, she hadn't been invited. The other vacant place, the one filled by Gromf, was normally reserved for Xerith's closest drow friend, matron mother Jenny Tiroth Tlabar. None had said it aloud, but Xerith understood the significance of the Beenri son's presence, and of the matron mother's failure to appear. Kiorl hated Jenny Tiroth, that was no secret, and so Jenny Tiroth had been left open as a sacrifice to delay the intrusions of House Oblodra. These other supposed allies, and the goddess they all served, had allowed Xerath's best friend to perish.
That thought bothered the matron mother for a short while, until she came to realize that she was the third highest-ranking drow in the meeting chamber. If the summoning was successful, if Kioral and Household Blodra were beaten back, then the hierarchy of the ruling houses would surely shift. Oblodra would fall, leaving vacant the third place, and since Feyn Tlabar was suddenly without a proper matron mother, it was feasible that House Orlarin could leap past it into that coveted spot. Jenny Tiroth had been given as a sacrifice. Xerath Cuse Orlarin smiled widely. Such were the ways of the drow. Into the brazier went Gromp's prized spider mask, a most magical item, the only one in all of Menzo Baranzon that could get someone over the House Baenri web fence. The flames shot into the air, orange and angry green. Miss Barris nodded to Baenri, and the withered old matron mother tossed in the lump of sulfur that the Avatar had given her. If 100 excited dwarves had pumped a huge bellows, their fire would not have been more furious. The flames shot straight up in a multicolored column that held the 8 watchers fast with its unholy glory.
"What is this?"
came a question from the front of the room near the only door.
"You dare hold a meeting of council without informing House Oblodra?"
Matron Baenri, at the head of the table and thus with her back directly to Kioral, held up her hand to calm the others gathered around the spider brazier. Slowly she turned to face that most hated drow, and the two promptly locked vicious stares.
"The executioner does not invite her victim to the block," Baenri said evenly. "She takes her there, or lures her in."
Baenri's blunt words made more than a few of the gathered drow uneasy. If Kioral had been handled more tactfully, some of them might have escaped with their lives. Matron Baenri knew better, though. Their only hope, her only hope, was to trust the Spider Queen, to believe with all their hearts that the Avatar had not steered them wrongly. When Kioral's first wave of mental energy rolled over Baenri, she too began to foster some doubts. She held her ground for some seconds, a remarkable display of will, but then Kioral overwhelmed her, pushed her back against the table. Baenri felt her feet coming from the floor, felt as if a gigantic, unseen hand had reached out and grabbed her, and was now edging her toward the flames.
"How much grander the call to Loth will be," Kioral shrieked happily, "when Matron Baenri is added to the flames."
The others in the room, particularly the other 5 matron mothers, did not know how to react. Ms. Barris put her head down and quietly began muttering the words of a spell, praying that Loth would hear her and grant her this. Xerath and the others watched the flames. The Avatar had told them to do this, but why hadn't an ally, a Tanari or some other fiend, come through? In the sludge-filled abyss, perched atop his mushroom throne, Ertu greatly enjoyed the chaotic scene. Even through the scrying device Loth had prepared for him, the great Tanari could feel the fears of the gathered worshippers and could taste the bitter hatred on the lips of Kioral Odron. He liked Kioral, Ertu decided. Here was one of his own heart, purely and deliciously wicked, a murderess who killed for pleasure, a player of intrigue for no better reason than the fun of the game. The great Tanari wanted to watch Kioral push her adversary into the pillar of flame. But Loth's instructions had been explicit, and her bartered goods too tempting for the fiend to pass up. Amazingly, given the state of magic at the time, the gate was opening, and opening wide. Ertu had already sent one Tanari, a giant Glabrezu, through a smaller gate to act as messenger, but that gate, brought about by the Avatar herself, had been tenuous and open for only a fraction of a moment. Ertu had not believed the feat could be duplicated, not now. The notion of magical chaos gave the fiend a sudden inspiration. Perhaps the old rules of banishment no longer applied. Perhaps he himself might walk through this opening gate onto the material plane once more.
Then he would not need to serve as Lolf's lackey. Then he might find the renegade Doerden on his own, and after punishing the drow, he could return to the frozen Northland, where the precious Crenshinabon, the legendary crystal shard, lay buried. The gate was opened. Ertu stepped in, and was summarily rejected, pushed back into the abyss, the place of his 100-year banishment. Several fiends stalked by the great Tanari, sensing the opening, heading for the gate, but snarling Ertu